This presentation is about data assimilation for thermoacoustic instability. Thermoacoustic instability is a huge problem in rocket engines, and you can see two blown up rocket engines here after thermoacoustic instability. And these days it's also a problem in gas turbine engines, both land-based and those on aircraft. There are many elements to this presentation. The majority of the experiments were done by Francesco Garita. The Karman filter I present was done by Hans Yu and Luca Magri. And Ushnish Samgupta has been doing some pure data-driven machine learning on this. There's actually nothing on that in the presentation, but I may end up talking about it as we go on. So the story starts with this annual review paper that I wrote with Sujit in 2018. It was actually, the invitation to write it was in 2014, and between 2014 and about 2016 when we wrote it, I must have read about 200 articles on thermoacoustics going way back to the 1950s. And a common theme that runs through them is that thermoacoustic instability has been a problem since the 1930s. And the curious thing is that we understand the physics well. The physics is relatively simple. It is that if you compress a gas when it's cold, it doesn't take much work. And then if you add heat and increase the pressure when the gas is hot, and then expand the gas, you get more work out of the expansion phase than you put into the compression phase, and thereby turn heat into work. And now if you replace the piston of the car engine with a simple acoustic wave, which is doing the compressing and decompressing, you find that if you get extra heat release at moments of higher temperature and pressure, and a bit less heat release at moments of lower temperature and pressure, then you turn some of that heat release rate into work, and thereby increase the amplitude of the acoustic wave. So that's the mechanism, we understand it well. And yet, engineers have never been able to reliably eliminate thermoacoustic instability before full engine tests. To take an extreme example, the F1 engine of the Apollo program on the Saturn V, they required about 2,000 full-scale engine tests at enormous cost in order to eliminate thermoacoustic instability. And this is because thermoacoustic systems are so sensitive to small design changes that any models of these systems contain severe systematic error. So if you're trying to design out thermoacoustic instability on the drawing board, the problem is that the model you have of the thermoacoustic instability is not sufficiently accurate, that your design has not got any thermoacoustic instability. So the idea of this project is to say, instead of trying to make a quantitatively accurate model a priori, can we start from a qualitative model of the physics, which we have quite a lot of confidence in, and then use lots of data from experiments to make that qualitatively accurate model quantitatively accurate? And the idea is to make it so over the range over which we test, but if it's a good physics-based model, then it should be able to extrapolate beyond the regions in which we've tested. Now, we didn't do this on a rocket engine or an aeroplane engine. We did this on a very simple thermoacoustic system. It's called a Rika tube. It's just a vertical tube, and in our case we have an automated iris at one end, which allows us to change the acoustic reflection coefficient at that end, and then we have an electric heater inside the tube as well. Now we can vary the power of the electric heater, and we do so from zero up to around 380 watts, and that sets up a convection current inside the tube. And the acoustics occurs on top of that, what we call the base flow. And the first part of this project was to quantify what that base flow was. So we do that with a simple one-dimensional conjugate heat transfer model. So we have a flow in the middle. The flow goes, what we have here in the box on the left is a slice of the Rika tube. The flow moves up from bottom to top. It's a buoyancy-driven flow. We imagine that we have plug flow inside, so just a uniform velocity profile at a certain temperature TG, which is a function of X, which is the downstream distance. And over some distance, delta X, there's some heat transfer from the gas to the solid walls, and then on the outside from the solid walls to the external gas, which is at temperature TA. So this is simple second year undergraduate stuff. Heat comes in at the flame or the heater at this point. Downstream of that, you have a high temperature, and then as heat gets lost to the walls and thereafter to the atmosphere, the temperature drops, and upstream, of course, we have a uniform temperature at the ambient temperature of the air. So the temperature of the gas is ambient temperature. It jumps when it passes the heater, and then we get an exponential decay very, very nearly through the rest of the tube. And we have the temperature of the wall as well, which is what we can measure very easily with the thermocouples. And now we have a model with a number of parameters, which I'll talk about in a minute, and a number of measurements, which are the thermocouples. Right, the parameters are the inviscid or viscous loss coefficient at the heater. In fact, we found that above a heater power of around 50 watts, the loss mechanism seemed all to be inviscid, so we dropped KV. We just stick with KI, the inviscid pressure loss coefficient across the wire. In other words, pressure drop is half rho U squared, where that's the velocity of the air going through the tube, times KI. Obviously, we have G, which we know well. HI is the heat transfer coefficient from the gas to the wall of the Rieger tube, and H outer is the heat transfer coefficient from the wall of the tube to the gas outside. So those are the parameters. Now for the measurements, we have a set of thermocouples on the outside. We have a thermocouple at the bottom on the inside. This is the air going through the tube, and one measuring the temperature at the exit. What I'm showing here is the very first setup we had. It's no surprise from what I'll show later, but I'll say it now, that you find that the air temperature is really what we need for the, so the gas temperature inside the tube is really what we need for the acoustic model. And actually we found it was, because that's such an important measurement, we found it far better to just squeeze some thermocouples inside the tube and measure that temperature directly. So although not shown here, that was one of the key measurements that we did take in the third round of experiments. So having explained the parameters that we'll be assimilating and the measurements that we have, I'll now move on to one of those parameters. That's the inviscid loss coefficient here at the heater, and show the experiments in which we work out what this inviscid loss coefficient is. On the horizontal axis here, we have time in hours. So each experiment lasted 23 hours, and then with an 1 hour turnaround time, we'd start another one. During that time, we'd increase the heater power from zero to 10 watts, and then 20 watts, 30 watts, etc., until we got to 180. Now, we define the state of the system as the temperature as a function of x, and we measure this at a certain number of points. The temperature is both of the gas and of the wall, and on top of that state vector containing the temperature, we put the parameters that we're assimilating, the inviscid loss coefficient, the Nusselt number on the inside and the Nusselt number on the outside. As time goes on, we use an ensemble Kármán filter to assimilate this data. So this works by running 50 ensembles of simulations of the flow with slightly different values of KI and slightly different values of the state and of HI and HO. And then every second we incorporate the data from the experiments, and then that collapses the state down and the parameters down to something more accurate. We then inflate those slightly and then move on again for another second and repeat the process. So we're doing this process every second. And as we do so, KI is converging to what it is at that moment in time. It's worth saying that this experiment never reaches steady state. So we end up having to have a sort of dynamic model that's moving very, very slowly in time. And then we do these acoustic pings I'll talk about later, last around a second. So the flow is quasi-steady during an acoustic ping, but it's not steady in time in the sense it doesn't reach a steady state. So what you can see here is the inviscid loss coefficient. Let's look at the red and the black line to start with. These, by the way, at a heater position of 0.45 and 0.55, so that's roughly in the middle of the tube. You can see that KI, this inviscid loss coefficient, starts off quite high, a little bit lower. Once we get to around 50 watts, it settles down to something at around 9. What we're seeing here is that the flow, laminar at very low powers, becomes sort of lazy turbulent flow. We get an inviscid loss at this heater here that is modelled quite nicely by a single loss coefficient KI over a large range of heater powers. And that's a reasonably large range of velocities. We'll come on to that later. Another thing worth noting is that when the heater is at 0.4 and 0.5, this actually coincided with the position of the thermocouple. So we threw away the information from that thermocouple. And this is obviously the thermocouple not just on the outside, but on the inside as well. And when you do so, you throw away your most valuable bit of information, which is the temperature just across the other side of the heater. And this really is reflected in the results you see here. For the green and the yellow lines, we've thrown away our most valuable piece of information, and the assimilation, the values, well, not bad, are definitely not as good as they are for the red and the black lines. And I think one of the hazards of this process is that process shines a light on bad experimental design. Every time you run it, you think, oh, I could have designed it a little bit better. And that's why this is our third round. I'm presenting here the third round of experiments. And even then, you know, you can still design it better. So I think experimental design could be an entire talk in itself. So I'll skip over that point and move on to the next chart, which is for the Nusselt number on the outside. So that, if you like, is the non-dimensional heat transfer coefficient from the metal tube on the outside to the air outside. And here, much the same story, as a function of time, or equivalently heater power, we see the Anson-Nusselt number converging to something sensible around 100. And for the black and the red, that doesn't change a great deal. For the other two, it does vary a bit. In this case, we actually expect the Nusselt number on the outside to scale with the Grashof number to the power of 1/4. So we expect this to increase slightly as the heated power goes up. And that indeed is what we see for the black and red lines. But not greatly. So this is taking a Nusselt number on the outside of roughly constant of 100 is reasonable, again, across a wide range of heater powers. And then we do for the same for the Nusselt number on the inside, the heat transfer coefficient from the gas to the wall. And here we're seeing, again, for the black and the red lines, reasonably constant, and not totally constant, but a reasonably constant value of the Nusselt number on the inside over a wide range of heater powers, and much more uncertainty in the yellow and the green, because we don't have that information about the temperature just downstream of the heater. So this is our data assimilation of the base flow. We're really doing it to get this, which is the velocity of the flow going through the tube. Within the model, this is a plug flow velocity profile. That's all the model does. We didn't go any more detailed than that. And you can see the velocity going from around 0.2 meters per second up to roughly 0.5 meters per second as the power increases. Now, we tried to measure this. The problem is, if you put a hot wire anemometer at the bottom, you get radiation from the heater, and that really disrupts the hot wire signal. We tried that. We tried shadowgraphy. We tried all sorts of things. We could guess from looking at the pictures that of the shadowgraphy that the speed was of this order, something under a meter per second, certainly. But with this model, and particularly with knowledge of the temperature jump across the heater and knowledge of the heater power, you can get flow rate and therefore the mass flow rate and therefore the velocity through the tube. And this is a number that we use later when we come to the thermoacoustic model. Okay, so having quantified the base flow, and as a reminder, this base flow changes slowly over time. It never reaches steady state, but at the same time, over the ping that I'll describe next, we can consider the flow to be quasi-steady. And then we do an acoustic experiment on top, which I'll talk about now. For the acoustic experiment, there are two types. I'll explain one here. We have a speaker at the bottom of the tube, which creates a ping. This is listened to by six probe microphones. So this is what a ping looks like. On the bottom axis here, we have time. This is in seconds. So 0 seconds here, 1 second, 2 seconds. So the whole bottom axis is 2.5 seconds. And what we see here are the pressure signals from the different microphones. So in green, we have a microphone very near the downstream end. Red is one bit further upstream, so about here. Blue, and then these two here are very close to the middle. They're not actually shown exactly where the microphones are shown here. And so the ping consists of a forcing for just about 1 second, very near to the natural frequency of the tube. And so you can see the response of the tube here, and all the microphones increases to a steady state amplitude. Actually, in this period here, we can get the reflection coefficient of the downstream and the upstream end, if we can see the upstream end through the heater. And then thereafter, we switch off the loudspeaker, and there's exponential decay for the rest of the time in all of the microphones. And again, in that period there, we can get the reflection coefficient of the downstream end, which does actually change a little bit during the decay rather than during the forced signal. Now here on this axis, we have here the decay of a ping experiment. In this case, the ping wasn't quite the same. It was far more abrupt, but the main point is the same. Once the ping finishes, you get a very nice period of linear decay. Now, depending on the decay rate, this will be 200 or 300 or even 500 cycles. So we get this linear decay over a lot of cycles. It means that we can get this decay rate very, very accurately. One rather nice thing about this experiment is that we're often looking at the case that's very close to marginal stability. So the decay rate is measured over many hundreds of cycles, and again, we can get that very accurately. The error increases if this period is shorter, in other words, if the decay rate or the growth rate is much greater. And I'll just mention we have another set of experiments where we use active control to keep the system stable, switch off the active feedback control, and then measure the growth rate as well. Now, I think the neatest example of the data assimilation done over the acoustics is actually to look at the case of the tube with the heater inside it, but with the heater switched off. So what we have here on the there are four figures. Let's look at the top left figure. On the horizontal axis is the position of the heater within the tube, ranging from the bottom end at zero to around halfway at 0.55. And on the vertical axis on the top left figure, we have the decay rate of oscillations. The real part of S is the growth rate, and being negative, that means this is a decay rate. And then here we have the frequency, which we've moved into hertz rather than radians per second, because it's just marginally easier to understand. What we see here on the left is the case of a tube containing the heater alone. Now, the first thing we did was take the heater out and measure the reflection coefficient at both ends of the tube, assuming they're the same. Once we've done that, we put the heater in, and what we find is that the decay rate increases when you put the heater in. This is basically due to thermoviscous dissipation of the heater. Part of that is the viscous dissipation, very like what we saw before for the flow past the heater. You basically get a force in the opposite direction to the local velocity around the heater, a drag force. But that's not all. You also have to include another more subtle effect, which is that the as an acoustic wave passes something that has thermal inertia, it transfers heat to that object that has thermal inertia. There's always a heat transfer across a finite temperature difference. That causes an entropy increase, which therefore, think of that as turning mechanical energy into thermal energy, and that acts as a source of damping on the system. Now, in this case, you have to model both of those effects. And what you see here is the results when we say, we'll add in a thermoviscous effect and calibrate the parameters of that to the experimental data. So the experiments are the open circles that you see here. And the model, once those parameters have been tuned, is in the stars. And you can see that it works very, very well. You match the frequency and the decay rate very accurately just with those parameters in the model. And here there are four of them. There's the absolute value of the viscous dissipation, which we'll call K viscous at the heater. There's a thermal value, which we call K thermal at the heater. But there's also a time delay, which you also have to include. And we initially were surprised by that time delay. But if you go back to Lighthill's 1954 paper on that, you discover that's in there and indeed has exactly the same sign as the one that we've discovered experimentally, although the sizes are not quite the same. So we've now, on the left, calibrated the cold model. Now, I mentioned that we discovered in our third set of experiments that we put thermocouples inside the tube. When you put thermocouples inside the tube, you get the results on the right-hand side. So this has a thermocouple and the heater. You find there's almost no change at all to the frequency, but the decay rate has increased. So this line here has shifted down a bit. And that's simply due to the thermoviscous mechanism at the thermocouples. So we have one more parameter to tune for that. It's simply the K thermal of the thermocouples, and we link it to have the same proportion as that for the heater. So there's just one extra parameter, but we can fit the results very nicely again. And this is for the cold flow case. Now, the technical details of fitting for that, this is essentially fitting least squares. It's quite simple. You can also work out the uncertainty as well, but that's not shown here. And now we turn on the heater and look at the thermoacoustic effect. Now this is a work in progress. We have a simple model in this case. We say the heat release rate at some time t is n, which is just a number, times the velocity at some time t minus tau, so with a time delay. So this is a simple n tau model. It's the simplest model that contains the physics that we're trying to emulate here, that we're trying to model. And it's very commonly used in thermoacoustics, and it's a very sensible place to start. The results I'm going to show right now, we say that n is just some number kn times q bar, which is the heat release rate, and tau, we say, is some number k tau times 0.2 times the d wire diameter of the wire divided by u-bar. This is why we needed to get u-bar from the baseflow model. And that comes from Lighthill's 1954 paper about heat release rate around a wire. And now we assimilate the data to work out the most probable values of Kn and k-tau and their uncertainty. Now, this is a work in progress, and actually what I'm presenting here are the results from the very first round of experiments we did. And you can see here Kn on this axis, k-tau on this axis. This is the most probable value at the middle here, and you can see here plus or minus roughly two standard deviations here, one standard deviation here. This is the percentages here. And you can see that this is a nice sort of circle rather than being a long thin line. In other words, Kn and k-tau are sort of nicely decorrelated from each other, nicely independent of each other, which implies they're good choices for parameters in the model to try to assimilate. So on the next slide, I'll present some published results looking at the case of the third round of experiments. On the horizontal axis is time, or if you like, heater power. On the vertical axis is decay rate at the top and frequency at the bottom. And what we have here in red is the model prediction, in black is the experiment, for an n-tau model. So on the left is just when we say n and tau are constants. And so we find the single value of n and the single value of tau that can match these 100,000 data points. And on the right, we stick n as well and then look at k-tau. So we're assuming here that k-tau, if I just go back a slide, is tau is k-tau times 0.2 dy upon u-bar. So we're using the u-bar in the second case and not in the first case. Now, so what we have here are two different models for the heat release rate of the wire. And you can fit the data reasonably well with both models. That's not a great surprise. And we're fitting the data, I think, reasonably well over a large range of heater powers and heater positions with just two parameters. Now, that, of course, presumes that you can do that, that when you move the heater up and down the tube, this time delay doesn't change, and n, which is the fluctuating velocity, causes a fluctuating heat release rate, and that just, you're assuming that n is the same wherever you place the heater. Now, in fact, our work shows us that isn't quite the case when the heater is very close to the entrance of the wire of the tube, for example. So it really makes you question your model, and I think that the question of how to deal with model error and comparing one model with another model is the sort of third layer here. It's the bit that you dig down to once you've been through all the other forms of data assimilation, and I think it's very tricky. And that's roughly where we are now. Now, all of this is or will be hopefully published in the ASME Turbo Expo 2020, of course, which is meant to be happening around now in London, but of course isn't taking place. But we have a paper on that, which details the experiments and one type of data assimilation. It's a wonderful data set, and we won't just treat it with one type of data assimilation. I think we will do several different types of data assimilation on it. So I didn't mention how many experiments we have, but there are roughly 100,000 ping experiments, acoustic experiments, and then 23 hours of, I think, 10 days of experiments for the base flow. So a vast amount of experimental data. And we have two models here. One is the base flow model, one is the acoustic model, and we're tuning a handful of parameters to this very large data set. Now, we observe that when the model is qualitatively accurate, its parameters can be inferred accurately. It does require the model to be qualitatively accurate. And now I'm going to assert something, which is a question that's come up before. How do you avoid overfitting? And I think we do that because the model is physics-based. I think there's a lot to be said on that, and it really comes down to how do you choose a good model. Now, so what? I'd say this approach is like debugging a code in the sense that you run a code, debug it, and so on, but you're doing this for a physics-based model. So you're assimilating the data into a physics-based model. If it doesn't work, you go back and tweak the model and see whether the data fits it better. Now, I'm aware that to the data scientists, they don't like doing this sort of thing. I guess I come at this from a physics-based modeling approach, which is where you primarily want to be able to model your experimental data well. You can go on to do other experiments afterwards, or indeed save a set of experiments in order to check that model. But fundamentally, we want to model well. Now, experiments can be automated, and these simulation tools are well-developed. I think experimentalists and modelers should do this sort of process routinely. I think the day of plotting 10 results on a chart and then drawing a line through them really are coming to an end, because now you can do so many experiments and do proper assimilation instead of just drawing a line at best fit by eye. And the reason why we as a group are doing this is because once we've got an accurate model, we have all the tools already for adjoint-based gradients, then you have a procedure for optimal design. Often we are making these models in order to design something, and by making the model quantitatively accurate, we can now use that model for optimal design within the range over which we've tested it, and if it's a good model, beyond the range in which we've tested it. Now, what next? I think there's a lot to be done on refining physics-based models. We can use physical insight from adjoint-based sensitivities. You don't have to, but I think it really speeds things up when you do that. Now, if that fails, I think you could use data-driven models for some components of a physics-based model. And this perhaps is the way to get the best of both worlds. So when you know the physics well, you use a physics-based model. When you don't understand the physics well, you use a data-driven model, but a much smaller one. You don't try to make a data-driven model of the whole system. You try and make a data-driven model of part of the system. And just as a final point, experiments are great because you get so much data. I mean, think of CERN, vast amount of data, but they're tricky to set up. So, you know, it might take you, if you're CERN, 20 years to set up an experiment and then for one microsecond of results. We're not quite that extreme, but it still takes several months to set up an experiment that then runs for 10 days. But I think having got this good data set, I think it really is good for us to all share them. And the special interest group of the UK Fluids Network really gives us the forum to do that.